an appeal after a termination of parental rights case. There are two appellants. Have the two of you decided how you'd like to structure your time?
Your Honor, Ms. Ashman can start, and whatever she doesn't use, I will use. That's fine. She can take the bulk of the time. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Ashman. And I also want to make one more thing before we begin, one more comment, and that is, if you are watching this in the active speaker view, then you'll see the person who's speaking in a large screen and then everybody else in thumbnails, either at the top or along the side of the screen. And that's fine, but it's hard to see the clock because the clock is also one of our, it's not a speaker or a participant, but one of the screens shows the clock. So what we have been telling people is to make sure you can toggle to the gallery view, and that's in the top right-hand corner. You'll see a rectangle with three dots on top of it. You can hover over that and right-click to toggle between speaker view and gallery view. If you put it to gallery view, then you'll be sure to see the clock at all times. And I think that makes more sense than trying to guess how much time you've used as your argument continues. All right, Ms. Ashman.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Attorney Amy Ashman, and I represent the appellant father. And this is the appeal from the termination of appellant father's parental rights to his two children. And the crux of his appeal is that reasonable efforts were not provided to appellant father. That in regards to reasonable efforts, they are required unless a determination has been made otherwise. And throughout this case, there was no determination or court order otherwise. And in regards to services, that they must go beyond matters of mere form to include real, genuine assistance, which appellant father contends did not occur here. In regards to the case plan, the county social worker testified that appellant father had met the items required in his case plan. Really, every area of concern that the county had in regards to the father reunifying with the children or being with the children should be covered in the case plan. The case plan is intended to give notice at the very least in regards to what the requirement is, and really ideally the roadmap for the return of children. And it is statutory that changes that are needed should be in that case plan for the children to return safely. The social worker testified here that the only beneficial service for unification provided was parenting classes. Yet the purpose of...
Can I just, before we get any further on this, I want to just make sure I understand. You are not challenging the district court's findings of fact, correct? But rather the legal conclusion that those facts amount to reasonable efforts.
Correct, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So there were findings, for example, that your client received chemical dependency services, for example, during his period of incarceration, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. He did receive chemical dependency services, but those were prior to the implication of the case plan. In regards to the social worker here, it was noted that it was...
Let me interrupt you for just a moment. Some of his chemical dependency treatment occurred while he was incarcerated. Some of that happened after the case plan originated. Am I correct about that, or am I misreading the record?
In regards to chemical dependency, the agency didn't require assist in any services for chemical dependency for the appellant father.
Right, but he was receiving chemical dependency treatment in prison. Am I correct about that or not?
Yes, Your Honors. In regards to when he had received the chemical dependency treatment, that time frame is a little bit unclear in the record, but that he had received chemical dependency treatment.
And what's your position as to the treatment need being met by the prison, even though it wasn't through the case plan?
It was, but appellant father's position would be is that in regards to the case plan, that didn't even or that wasn't even in the case plan. That was something that father learned at trial in regards to a potential, what the service that the county would have liked to have seen or would have liked to have seen additional efforts from appellant father. Can't quite remember where I left off, Your Honors, but in regards to it, the social worker testified the only beneficial service for reunification provided was the parenting class, which was noted at the time of the trial was in almost completed. And was also noticed that the did not want to add anything to the case plan because it didn't want to hinder his completion of the compliance of the case plan. Case plans aren't supposed to be easy. Case plans typically have the requirements that Human Services is looking for in regards to having the children back in the home, which typically do involve obstacles, which then are services supposed to be provided by the agency to help the appellant father in meeting those. In regards to it, appellant father, how was he supposed to know what to do if it wasn't in the case plan when not giving the when not given the opportunity to work towards those completion of the goals? In regards to the trial, really impossible standards were testified to in regards to appellant father to meet because they were really invisible requirements as they were not contained in the case plan. The case plan specifically notes that due to his release date of July 2020, that the agency was not looking to place the children in appellant father's care. Yet, how is the county supposed to know that at the time of entering into the case plan? There are many twists and turns to child protection cases, and his release date was not an unattainable release date. More specifically, the case plan did not comply with the statute to note specific actions or the time periods in regards to which actions were to be taken, which indicates that county had no intention of having the children placed with him. There should have been clear goals in the case plan, which indicated what services and goals were provided while incarcerated and then also after release to accommodate for both of those. So so that appellant father was very clearly aware of what was required for him to be with the children.
I'll jump in with another question. You've said that you're not challenging the fact findings of the district court. I just want to offer a couple of findings that on their face, I was not sure there was support in the record, but if you're not challenging them, I guess they stand as they are. But the district court found, I'm looking at finding number 36 and finding number 38 in particular, the district court found that due to the fact that father is in a controlled environment and has already completed chemical dependency treatment while in prison, the benefits of another chemical use assessment is extremely limited. And then in 38, the district court found that phone contact between father and the children was not appropriate due to the children's ages and lack of contact with the children, between children and father for the past 4 years. I wasn't sure what the district court didn't identify the support in the record for those two findings, either psychological assessments or any other. And I just want to be sure you're conceding those are fact findings that are not challenged on appeal.
Well, I would note that in regards to that specific finding, that if you look further on page 58, that it notes, the court notes that recognizes father's incarceration limited his ability to have contact with the children. So that there's essentially contradiction within the order in regards to contact or visitation with the children.
I guess my question is, you're not challenging the district court's finding that it would not have been appropriate for the father to have any phone contact with the children. You're not challenging that finding.
I guess, Your Honor, in regards to it, it's more so with the reasonable efforts that the appellate father is challenging in regards to the court. So to the extent that reasonable efforts are being challenged, that appellant father would be in disagreement with that.
Right, but you're saying that, well, I just want to go back to Judge Bjorkman's question. If you're not challenging any of the findings, if it was not appropriate for father to have any phone contact with the children, I gather that you do not believe it is one of the, that it would be the county's burden to provide phone contact between the two. That would not be a reasonable thing to do because the district court found, and you are not apparently challenging, that it was not appropriate for father and children to have phone contact.
And just further to go into that, in regards to a reasonable effort as it pertains to a plan, believe that the county is required to have a plan in place in regards to contact. And as contained in the findings and in the orders, there is a lack of a visitation plan that was provided to Mr. Avila, which includes things like ability to write the children in foster care as well.
Right, but as to phone contact, I just want to be clear that you are conceding that as a matter of fact, it is would have been inappropriate for father and children to have telephonic contact while he was in prison.
Right, and I guess in regards to that, I guess it's not necessarily a concession, Your Honor, but notes that there is contradiction in the order regarding that finding.
But you're not challenging the finding.
No, I'm challenging the reasonable efforts.
Okay.
So I have a question for you as well, counsel. The statute requires a case plan to be disclosed to parties at a certain point, well before trial. And so the question I have is, if there's something missing from that case plan, or if there's something that a party would disagree with about the case plan, when is it appropriate for them to challenge the case plan?
It is appropriate for them to challenge the case plan throughout the case. And I guess that would further go into my argument in regards, and that's contained in the brief from appellant father, that he was not given the opportunity to have court-appointed counsel until after the termination of parental rights was filed with the court.
Let me stop there too, because I want to make sure I understand things as well. He was a party or a participant to the child protection matter?
I can't recall, Your Honor. I was not appointed during the duration of the child protection case and came on after the termination had already been filed. So I would just note there's about 3 minutes left. I know Mr. Toulouse did generously offer for me to take most of it, and I have. I just want to give him an opportunity to present argument to the court as well. Thank you.
Go ahead, counsel.
May it please the court. Thank you this morning for your time to hear about this important matter. I will summarize my brief and our case regarding the mother very quickly, which is, it's clear that in her mind, she was only agreeing to voluntarily terminate her parental rights with an understanding, as she formed it, that her brother, a relative, also of Hispanic heritage, would be the considered placement option. If the court will look at my brief on pages 3 and 4, when she's asked about giving up her right to trial and to voluntarily terminate her rights, she responds, quote, yes, judge. can I have to remind the lawyers that the relatives are the first to adopt. It's our position that she did this under duress when you take into account the facts of the case and the understanding that if she did not voluntarily terminate her parental rights, future children would be subject to jurisdiction of the court as well. And we also tie in that with my third argument that the court could find beginning on page 5, talking about the culturally appropriate foster home, Minnesota statute 260C.212 talks about the best interests, and amongst those best interest factors are the cultural heritage of children and how that would affect them growing up. I would also, the court has before it a significant amount of paperwork that was part of the court record. If the court reviews that, it will no doubt be able to understand the trauma that my client has occurred over her lifetime. Her childhood growing up in Texas is particularly traumatic. She also has had some injuries, and it's pretty clear based upon the information that she provided to the court and the way she testified at the voluntary termination that she did so under duress and not with a full understanding of the consequences.
Can I turn to back to your first argument that she was not voluntarily terminating her parental rights? Are you suggesting that there is nothing in the record from which the district court could infer that she was voluntarily terminating her parental rights without the strings attached to it that you say were attached?
I would think that's an impossible argument for you to make. I believe there is items in the record that would justify that.
Well, if that's so, and we're looking only to, and it's a fact finding that we have to evaluate based upon the clearly erroneous standard, isn't it necessary then that we affirm at least on the question of whether she voluntarily terminated? I'm not saying so with regard to your duress argument, but at least as it regards the voluntariness of her termination of parental rights?
I would only suggest that there is an equal argument in the record that would reflect there was duress and it wasn't voluntary.
And if there's equal evidence and it's a clearly erroneous standard, we would have to affirm, wouldn't we?
I believe you, yeah, clearly erroneous is more than 50-50. I would concede that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Turning to respondents' counsel, Ms. Springstead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Nicole Springstead, and I represent Southwest Health and Human Services in this matter. The district court did not err in finding Southwest Health and Human Services proved by clear and convincing evidence that reasonable efforts were provided to reunify DA with the children. For non-custodial parents, reasonable efforts towards reunification requires the agency to exercise due diligence to assess a non-custodial parent's ability to provide day-to-day care for the children and, where appropriate, provide services necessary to enable the non-custodial parent to safely provide that care. DA has been in a controlled environment since September of 2016. He did not have a relationship with the children prior to the children going into or being adjudicated in need of protection or services, and he did not have a relationship with the children at the time of the trial.
Can I jump in with a question here? I'm not sure one way or the other, based upon the briefing and the oral argument, whether it's being challenged or not, but I will tell you I was a little unclear about the basis for the district court's finding that it was, quote, not appropriate, close quote, for father and children to have any telephonic contact based on the children's ages and lack of contact. So what is there in the record? Assume that's a finding that's been challenged as lacking evidentiary support. What is the basis for the district court's determination that it is, quote, not appropriate, close quote, for a father to contact children by phone?
I guess I can't speak necessarily for the judge, but as far as the history of the case is concerned, if you look at the child protection case and those orders have come in through judicial notice, so they are part of the record, DA never asked for visitation with the children.
No, I understand that. I mean, I'm in the context of what reasonable efforts the state, the county undertook. You've got a father and a child. One of the things that might be reasonable in providing services is having contact with the two. If the goal is reunification, presumably there would need to be some communication. So that's not a factor, of course, if it was, quote, not appropriate, close quote, for this contact to occur. So I understand the father wasn't in contact before these proceedings. My question is, at the time of the case plan and throughout the case plan, what is the basis on which the district court would say that it's not appropriate for the father and children to have any communication by phone? Even assuming they hadn't been in contact before.
That would be part of it. And the other part of it would be the young age of the children. The other part of it would be the domestic violence that had been observed.
Pause there. The district court doesn't refer to domestic violence, but the district court referred to the children's age. So what is it about the children's age that would make it inappropriate to have a telephone conversation between father and children in an effort to break this lack of communication barrier towards reunification?
I would submit based on their ages of 6 and 5 at the time, that was fairly young for not having contact with him since 2016. My recollection of the testimony is that the agency felt based on their ages being that young of 6 and 5 and that they hadn't had contact with him for such a long period of time that it wouldn't be a meaningful conversation or connection with the father to have those communications. And the agency looked at those other issues. I realize, Your Honor, it's not in the record.
In an effort to reunify, help me to understand what steps could be taken to reunify father and children if telephone communication cannot occur. Presumably, I mean, I would understand the district court's statement if it was, we don't want children to come to prison for the first time to see their father. But the idea that they're not allowed even telephonic communication seems at least alien to me, and I don't understand the basis for it. Maybe you can explain the logic of it to me, since it doesn't seem as if the district court built it on anything that you've identified in the record.
The only thing I can say, Your Honor, is once again, can't speaking for the district court judge, but based on the information that was available, there was information regarding that domestic violence. There was information regarding no contact. I understand what Your Honor is saying. We do have, while we were apart, which is something that we do offer in some cases, it's geared more towards older children. That is something that is offered occasionally when...
I don't understand why it would not be available for younger children. I mean, 5, 6 years old is not too young to have a telephone conversation. And no one is indicating that the children had to be made aware that father was in prison at that time, or even if he was. I'm at a loss for how there could be any reunification efforts that are meaningful. Let me go back a step. The argument is that there were not meaningful, reasonable efforts provided. And if he's not even allowed telephonic conversation with the children, I'm trying to get a sense of whether it was ever the intent to reunify father and child, or whether it was just the decision that it wasn't going to happen. So no efforts were undertaken. No real efforts were undertaken.
I would not submit that there were no real efforts. I understand the court's concern. I clearly am not answering it explaining why in the court's eyes that decision was made.
What would you point to as the most compelling demonstration that the social workers involved in the case or the county was intending to actually reunify father and child?
I would point to the fact that case plans were made, that DA was consulted when those case plans were made. The social worker had regular contact with DA regarding the requirements in the case plan. The social worker worked on trying to set up parenting classes when DA said that they weren't available, or he was on a waiting list or couldn't get into them. I can't recall exactly what his testimony was. But then the social worker went out of her way to try to find an online option for DA in order to complete those. Ultimately, it turned out that he was able to complete them, while in prison. She did also inquire with the case manager to see if any other programming could be made available for Mr. Avila. We learned about him being in chemical dependency treatment, learned about the counseling that he was undertaking. So I would submit to the court that there were efforts being looked at. She did look into what was available to Mr. Avila while he was in prison. If we had it to do over again, more than likely we would have tried to set up some type of communication with him and the children. We aren't there. That's not what occurred in this case. And as I'm going back to, that was primarily based on there was no relationship prior to him going into the prison system.
Was there any restriction on his ability to write letters?
To the best of my knowledge, no. And that was never a request made by DA. And if the courts are going to ask, I don't believe it was offered either, but I know the request was never made.
Yeah, I've never served in the role of social worker in case. I guess when it's something that seems so fundamental as just a lack of contact, I'm trying to get a sense of why it would be that a social worker would not try to offer opportunities for contact, either encouraging correspondence, written correspondence, or telephonic correspondence. And the district court did not say that it would be inappropriate for father and children to have written correspondence. And if that's so, why is it reasonable that that service wasn't offered or suggested to the father?
Once again, I'm going back to the fact that they did not have that relationship. And there is case law that says that it's not the responsibility of Southwest Health, or excuse me, an agency or the court to establish a relationship where one doesn't exist. Once again, hindsight being as it is, moving forward, this probably is something we're going to do in cases. But it was not done in this case based on the fact that the children had not had contact with him since 2016. There was that domestic violence in the background. I realize that that may not have been part of the court's decision, but that was something available to the social worker.
Give me a picture of what it would have looked like for us not to be here. Assume that the facts occurred differently and that termination was not sought as to father. How would that have looked? What would father have done differently so that termination wouldn't have been sought? What more would he have needed to do beyond the effort he'd made to fulfill the case plan?
I think being open and honest about what he was going to do once he was released from prison, that wasn't something that father shared with us until trial. All he said is he may live with some of his children, I believe. We didn't know anything about where he was going to be working. We didn't know for sure where he was
When you say open and honest, I gather then there's a point in the record you can identify where he was asked these questions and refused to provide the information. I know that he did offer what he was going to do, and the district court said, well, as I read the district court, well, he didn't prove that. He didn't provide evidence that the sister agreed to this arrangement, therefore, apparently it was disregarded as a possibility, but I'm wondering what opportunities he was given before, if any, and failed to meet them to provide the answers that you're saying were lacking.
My recollection of the record is Ms. Lundy did ask him what he was planning on doing when he was released from incarceration, and it was sketchy is not the right word I'm looking for, but it wasn't concrete. So I think if he would have come to Ms. Lundy a little bit before the day of trial and told her, this is what I'm planning on doing. I'm planning on living with my daughter. I'm planning on, you know, these people are in her apartment. I want to get into outpatient treatment. This is where I'm going to be working. Ms. Lundy, the social worker would have had an opportunity to get in touch with the daughter to make sure that that was an appropriate housing situation. She may have been able to travel out to, I believe, North Dakota to observe where he would be living. She also would have had the opportunity to look into outpatient treatment opportunities in that area and check in with his employer, because he didn't tell her any of that prior to the day of trial while he was testifying. She didn't have an opportunity to even look into those resources for him. You know, I believe.
And, I yet, would, And yet, counsel, I believe Ms. Lunde's testimony at trial was that father did everything that he could to comply with the case plan. And how could he have done something when he was still incarcerated?
Well, and I think that's part of the concern too. I mean, when you look at the case, I realize incarceration is not a reason to terminate. And we completely understand that and why that's why these efforts were made. But when he's saying he's still struggling with chemical dependency, when he's saying the DA is saying he needs this assistance, the Human Services has never been able to see him outside of this controlled environment. The last we know of him is having contact with the children in 2016. And there were some situations where he wasn't necessarily caring for the children on his own and where he left the children with BT, who was having some sobriety issues herself.
Right, but in termination of parental rights cases, the standard is what are the conditions right now, not what were they before the case plan originated. And right now, as of the time of trial, we know that he's gone through chemical dependency. As far as we know, he's clean. Obviously, it's a controlled environment. But fact is, people do violate rules in prison, and they are able at times to get their hands on controlled substances. How, I don't know, but it happens. There's no indication that that occurred here. I understand your acknowledgement that, well, the law is pretty clear that just because someone's incarcerated doesn't mean that termination occurs. I'm having a hard time distinguishing this case from simply that conclusion, that father's incarcerated, so therefore we're going to terminate. Now, I know there are elements here that don't just jump to that conclusion, but by saying, well, he doesn't have housing. We know he's in prison, so he can't get housing. He's not going to be able to, no landlord's going to sign a lease with him while he's in prison. And I know that's not the agency's responsibility, but when he shows up in court and says, I have this plan in place, and to have that plan discounted simply because he didn't corroborate it with the sister's agreement seems a little bit short of clear and convincing to me, but that's just my perspective. And I know my question has pushed you over the time. Maybe Judge Brian may allow you a moment to respond to my statement, treating it as a question.
Go ahead.
I would just admit that, as you stated, there are reasonable efforts. The judge does outline some reasonable efforts that were placed there. And I think it did go beyond mere, you know, it wasn't just, we have to do this. I mean, there were efforts that were made and put into that. And I guess specifically to address the issue of, well, of course, a landlord's not going to let him sign a lease when he's in prison. Even if he would have shared the facts that he was going to live with his daughter, that would have been a phone call. That would have been something that Ms. Lund or the social worker could have easily contacted the daughter and had a conversation with her. And she could have had testimony about that to say, hey, yeah, this is a viable option. Unfortunately, we also have to look at how long the children were in out-of-home placement. By the time he was released, they would have been in out-of-home placement over 365 days. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll turn back to the appellants, and I suppose we'll start with you, Ms. Ashman.
Thank you, Your Honor. At this time, for rebuttal, I have nothing in addition to present. I believe that the brief, as well as what's already been argued today, is sufficient for appellant father. Thank you.
Ms. Ashman, let me ask you this. What evidence was presented at trial that would support a finding that father could safely parent these children at the present time, meaning at the time of the trial?
Could you restate your question, please?
Yeah, I mean, a termination decision, you know, is bound by the conditions that exist at the time of trial, correct? And
yes.
Setting aside that his release date was that your client's release date was a couple of months down the road, what evidence suggests that when he got out of prison, he would be in a position to safely parent these children?
I guess my response would be is that there isn't evidence otherwise that was presented to the court, and that's contained in the court order. Thank you.
I'm doing good right now.
Mr. Toulouse.
Thank you. I would just reiterate, if the court looks at the record that was before the trial court, the court will see that the progress made by my client, the mother, and the work she did on the case plan was in fact quite significant. And this was more of a case where the agency could have, although it chose not to, asked for an extension of those timelines in a case like this. And given the substantial compliance that she had with the case plan, and in fact, if you look at the orders that were issued prior to the final termination order, and if you look at the reports that are part of the court record, there is regular and consistent reference to she's doing well, the case is making progress, she's working hard on the case plan, and yet we ended up in the same ending place that we hoped we wouldn't anyway. And again, it didn't have anything to do with my client's efforts. It had to do with her, the decision by the agency, which they are allowed to make, which was, we don't think she can properly parent the kids. So, again, I think that's tied hand in hand with the duress argument. A person who completes these things over and over and does the case plan and works hard in the case plan, then.
But isn't it something that she's weighing the risks at the time, the risks of going forward and putting all the evidence that you're talking about into the record, making the arguments that you would have had her make, you know, the risk that that's not enough and that she would be involuntarily terminated if she took that path versus some certainty that comes with a voluntary termination. And isn't it a matter of weighing the risks at the time? And she made a decision. And how was the distinction, the legal distinction, as far as it relates to someone's future ability to be a parent, how was that by itself coercive?
I do think your question is an excellent one. I think the idea that she did this under duress is tied to whether or not she can actually make that decision voluntarily and understandably, and given the facts of the case. So I guess I would argue that she couldn't make that decision voluntarily, in fact, given what was said about her in the court reports. Thank you.
I have a question about your duress argument. When was the first time during the proceedings that the argument was made that mother was under duress in voluntarily terminating her parental rights?
I think that the first time that argument was made was on the appeal.
And why would we treat that issue as not forfeited, having failed to raise it in the district court?
I think there was no indication that it should have been raised at the hearing. In fact, the court would not have accepted the voluntary termination then.
All right, thank you. I see your time has expired. Are there any other questions? I have none. Seeing shaking of heads and mouthing the word no, I think I will thank the parties one more time for their willingness to participate in this way. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an order within the statutory timelines. Thank you all very much.